and in Baltimore, where people are saying that's a great idea. So I'm asking all the young workers, militants that are interested in a working class party, that it's there, people want. We are it. We're the working class. We can change society. We have the power to do it. We need to organize it and centralize it and lead a big fight.
Yes. All right. Well, Juan Ray, thank you. Thank you so very much. Thank you so very much. Marie and I thank you for being with us today. And I encourage our audience to learn more about your campaign, about your opponent's campaign. See what you think, folks, before you go to the polls on election day and make up your own mind. We're going to take a brief early station ID break, if we can, a few minutes early, because then we're going to move into the very hot, sadly, very hot topic of a widening Middle Eastern war. Dear me, may it become a world war. We're going to talk about that and other matters concerning it right after this brief station ID.
Yo, this is Immortal Technique. Right now, you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles. Revolutionary commentary. You know what it is. KPFK bringing you the realness. Peace.
Harlem streets stay flooded in white powder.
Indeed, after that short break, we are back with you. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm still Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Maria Hall. We first brought you the voice of a working class candidate in the 37th Congressional District. And now to the to the headline issues of the day, if you will. After months of back and forth attacks between Israel and Lebanon, a much wider war has, as many had been predicting and fearing, now unfolded in earnest. Israel's defense forces launched what they claim is a limited and targeted ground operation in southern Lebanon, which of course leaves open the question, but for how long, how limited, and how targeted? Forces in Iran supporting Hezbollah and Lebanon have launched over 200 ballistic missiles into Israel. There's been damage there, as well as massive damage in Lebanon and now in Iran as well. The Biden administration, and in Syria, I should say, Israel struck there and killed people there as well. The Biden administration, promising to defend Israel in its widening war, has already sent several more thousands of U.S. troops to the area where there are already 40,000 U.S. troops already there. The U.S. military has really already joined the war on Israel's side by, well, joining in Israel's attacks and defensive military operations against Iran. While Secretary of Defense Austin has already warned that there would be serious consequences for Iran if it is attacking Israel, which of course it has done. The UN peacekeeping mission, while remaining in position on the ground there, has announced it can no longer carry out its patrols to carry out its mission due to the intensity of the back and forth military attacks. And meanwhile, again, the Israeli military assaults in Gaza continue, along with the suffering of the Palestinian people, even as the focus of the war news now is on, well, just how wide this widening Middle East war will eventually expand. Happily, to help us understand this fast-moving, fast-expanding war, we're fortunate to have with us today Richard Becker. Mr. Becker is the Western Regional Coordinator of the ANSWER, Anti-War, Anti-Racism Coalition, and a leader in the Party for Socialism and Liberation. ANSWER has been a key organizer of many of the mass protests against the U.S.-Israeli war on the Palestinian and Lebanese people. Richard Becker is also an expert on the Middle East and on the long-running struggle of the Palestinian people to end the Israeli occupation of their country. Mr. Becker has written on this topic, including his much-heralded book, Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. He's written as well, in fact, has a new edition of that book out right now, I should say, very timely. You can get the new edition of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire by going to 1804books.com. You know, the number, 1804books.com. Richard is also the author of The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. Well, Richard Becker, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks very much, Jim. Thanks, Maria.
Dick, recently more and more attention, of course, is being paid to Israel's so-called Daya doctrine. Don't generally hear a lot about it, but you begin to hear more about it. Now, what is this doctrine? What are the implications of this Israeli doctrine with regards to, well, the widening war in the Middle East that we're now experiencing?
Well, this is a very important issue, and one that has been, I think, covered up in the media here for a long time. You know, under international law, of course, Israel and the U.S. don't pay much attention to that, but under international law, it is illegal. It's a grave violation to use disproportionate force on civilian areas, and that the combatants are required to try to spare civilians as much as possible. But this is what, in 2008, and I think that had been going on for a long time before, but this is what General Gadi Eisenkot, who was the North Command general in charge of the North Command of Israel, and he explained what they had done in 2006 in the war. He said, "We will apply disproportionate force on a village and cause great damage and destruction. From our standpoint, these are not civilian villages. They are military bases. This is not a recommendation. This is a plan, and it has been approved." And he went on to become the chief of staff of the general staff of the Israeli military before retiring in 2019. But clearly, for anyone who has observed in any way the war against Gaza, against the Palestinians in Gaza, and the war that's now expanded against Lebanon, you can see that it is clear that the Dahiya doctrine is in full force. And the Dahiya doctrine is named after the Dahiya suburb of southern Beirut, where the Lebanese organization Hezbollah had its headquarters. And in the war of 2006, most of that area was leveled with over 1,000 civilian casualties, about a third of them children. It caused enormous damage to the country's civilian infrastructure, including power plants, sewage treatment plants, bridges, port facilities, and of course to the civilians themselves. And it's no accident. And the Israeli military and Israeli government are proud to say that they use this doctrine, that they fight under this doctrine, which again is in complete violation of international law. But because Israel has the backing of the U.S., the support of the U.S., they feel that they don't have to pay any attention to that.
Well, Dick Becker, as the death toll keeps rising in Gaza and Lebanon, the U.S. keeps declaring that, quote, Israel has a right to defend itself, even as Israel keeps finding ways not to agree to U.S. brokered ceasefire proposals. But the U.S. has also cautioned Israel not to directly target Iran's nuclear facilities, since that would likely tip the conflict out of control. So my question to you is, how likely is it that Israel will nevertheless target those facilities? And if they do so, do you have any doubts about whether the U.S. will continue to support and join Israel in a widening Middle East war?
Well, if we look at the last several months, there have been a number of occasions in which Biden or one of his top advisors has said that something is a red line, like this most famously, that if Israel went into Rafah, where much of the population early in the war had been forced into the southern, which is like the southern third of Gaza, or southern or western third of Gaza, that would be crossing a red line from the U.S. point of view. Then Israel did it, and nothing happened, except that the delivery of one-ton bombs and artillery shells continued unabated. Nothing happened that would, and of course, this was a message that the Israeli government understood very clearly, that they could do what they want to do. If they bomb the nuclear facilities, were to bomb the nuclear facilities in Iran, This, of course, raises the possibility of an even greater catastrophe. And the dispersal of nuclear materials, which could have, of course, the most catastrophic effects. But, you know, I don't think that Netanyahu feels that he has to pay attention to what the U.S. says at this point, and has enough support within the U.S. ruling establishment to keep carrying out one genocidal act after another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly seems that way, doesn't it, Dick? And, you know, for months and months now, Israel, well, for years and years and years, for decades, Israel has been at war in Palestine with the Palestinian people. And just as that war heated up again in October last, about a year at it now, billions more U.S. Dollars in terms of ammunition, planes, bombs, as you mentioned, and so forth, have been sent to Israel. It's also noteworthy that in the same way that Hamas didn't attack the U.S., Iran has not attacked the U.S. Nevertheless, in both instances, the U.S. has joined the war on Israel's side and is effectively in military operations against Palestine, against Hamas, and now effectively against Iran and Lebanon as well. So I wonder if it might not make sense to pause for a minute and have you remind our listeners why the United States has bound itself so unquestionably for so long to Israel in the Middle East. Why, in fact, Israel was created in Palestine in the first place.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting to look at the history and you know, in terms of the mainstream media here, we don't get any real history. Yeah. You get like a photo once in a while of, you know, some people who've been displaced or something like that. But, you know, the state of Israel could not have come into being without the support. And now the Zionist project would never have produced the state of Israel without the support of one or another of the imperialist powers, nor could it continue without their support. You know, what's a very interesting contradiction that the Zionist project had at the beginning was that it openly, clearly stated that it was a colonial project. But it was a very odd colonial project in that it didn't have an army and it didn't have a navy. It had did not have the means of violence to become a colonizer and so had to find a sponsor. And 20 years after their first Congress, the first World Zionist Congress, in 1917, they got the Balfour Declaration, and the British, in effect, then became took over Palestine the next year, and became the sponsor by which the State of Israel would come into being in 1947. They left in 1948, the British, and who came in at that point were the French. A little ways into the 1950s, France became the main armor of the State of Israel. They worked together, and that's how Israel got the atomic bomb. They got it from the French. The French scientists, technicians, brought the material and the know-how to do it. And that lasted until the 1967 war. And in the 1967 war, at a time of nationalist upheaval throughout the Middle East, a key strategic region, then considered the most key strategic region of the world, That at that time the Israeli military smashed the Egyptian military and smashed the Syrian. Syria was being called the Cuba of the Middle East at that time in the U.S. media, and it was at that time that Gerald Ford, then the House Minority Leader, but who would become president in 1974. He said, it looks like Israel has done a great job for us. We document this process in our book. And it was at that time that the U.S. military was impressed that Israel could be their agent in this key strategic region. And of course, that was very important because, as I know Jim Lafferty remembers, that was at the height of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. 550,000 U.S. troops were in And so, and people were saying, I even remember McGovern, the great liberal, supposedly, you know, or it was a great liberal, I guess. But he said in running in 1972, Vietnam's the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time. And everybody knew what was meant by that, that the Middle East was far more important. And so it was in 1969, Nixon got elected. Nixon and his advisors, Kissinger, came up with the Nixon Doctrine. And the Nixon Doctrine said Iran, where the U.S. had put the Shah back on the throne 15 years earlier, and Israel should become the poles, the pivots kind of around which U.S. domination of the Middle East could continue. And so it's been like that ever since. It was with the Nixon Doctrine that the aid to Israel went from the millions of dollars a year and maybe $100 million to billions. It was under Nixon that that happened, and it's continued up till today. And I think the essence of this is that Israel is regarded in the U.S. not anything to, with nothing to do with, you know, Jewish people or support for Jewish people or support for any people, but as an extension of U.S. military power and as a kind of giant military base, a small country from one perspective, but from the Pentagon perspective, a gigantic military base for patrolling and controlling the region.
Well, Dick Becker, do you believe that the Biden administration, in deciding to do what's been done and is doing, continues to do in this widening Middle East war, do you have any thoughts? What was given to, if anything, what kind of thought was done as to how this might impact the November presidential election? And in fact, do you think it's likely to have a significant impact on the election at all?
Well, we have a month to go. We have five weeks from yesterday, isn't it? Yep. The election will take place. And so there are many things that can still happen. I mean, there have been many, many surprises over the last year. And no one, you know, no one in the U.S. ruling establishment or the Israeli ruling establishment knew that October 7th was coming. They were all preparing for to carry forward the Abraham Accords, meaning these agreements between Israel, brokered by the U.S., between Israel and the Arab governments, leaving the Palestinians out, not considering their interests at all. So that's and a number of it happened during the Trump administration, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and others. And it was they were about to, Saudi Arabia was probably, I think, about to go in on it too. And so we had, this was, that was unexpected. That was completely unexpected. So many things have been unexpected since then. Even the fact that the war is still going on in Gaza. I mean, no one expected that would happen. So, and no one was anticipating, you know, what happened yesterday, that the Iranian, what the Iranians call the response to the massacres that are taking place in Gaza and in Lebanon. Now that poses the question, as you said earlier, of a wider war. And what will a wider war mean to the election? Well, it could mean almost anything. But, you know, it's we're in a time of very dramatic changes that are taking place and ones that are for the most part, very menacing.
You know, Dick, I was thinking as I was listening to your very clear answer on, you know, why has the U.S. been wedded to Israel? In fact, was responsible for its creation in large measure in the first place. And I'm reminding when one reads the history of that, you often come across this tale of you know, Britain and England and Russia discussing after the Second World War how they were going to divide up the spoils and what have you. And well, but then what are we going to do about the Jews, this Holocaust that happened? And, well, you know, I don't know, give them half of Germany or something. Yeah, maybe that makes sense. Russia said, you're not going to do that. We lost more people in the war than you did. That's ours, East Germany, and it was. But the U.S. had to have a place, as the history tells it, as I think you were saying as well, that if we're going to guard our interest in oil and our general geopolitical interest in that religiously different, racially different part of the world than the U.S. We sure as hell better have a country that we can, in a sense, call our own, even though it is arguably a sovereign country, of course. And there's been that partnership between the two countries that you described since. And for that reason, that had little to do with the Jewish people and Israel as we know it. But I guess the $64 question, nevertheless, is this, of course. And that's how much wider will this already much wide war become? And it's interesting to note in that regard that the Biden administration keeps saying that it believes Netanyahu cannot afford, to be anything but proportionate in its response, in its action, that therefore, for all sorts of political reasons they don't bother to necessarily enunciate, Netanyahu is in a tough place himself. He can't just go wild, you know, as frankly Israel did, obviously, in Gaza. On the other hand, General Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied U.S. Commander of NATO, has said, and I quote, "Israel will do its best to be disproportionate," close quote. So first of all, what is your view on whether Netanyahu will in fact act with any so-called proportionality, or is Wesley Clark more apt to be right? And what, if anything, does that tell you about how wide this war may get?
Well, it kind of takes us back to the Haya doctrine.
Yeah.
They have no intention of being proportionate. The state of Israel and its supporters hate to hear this said, but it's a state that's been based and created and based on terror. The driving out of 750,000 Palestinians in 1948-49. I mean, and then, you know, even after the conquest of 78% of what had been the colony, the mandate of Palestine, the British mandate of Palestine, and the Zionists were supposed to get 55%, they ended up with 78%. They considered that completely unacceptable and were saying so. They wanted what they called the second round, and they wanted it right away. In the 1950s, they carried out, talk about disproportionality. You know, the West Bank, there's no signs or anything or fences or anything, especially now, that separate. There was a time of Jordan that people who were expelled from their homeland in 1948-49, many of them lived right next to what the border, that border of Israel, the 1948. So people would come back. Farmers would come and try to farm. They would try to harvest their crops that hadn't been burned or destroyed. And then some would cross and try to fight just on their own. There were no organization. And the Israeli response to that was to send in units, Unit 101. Unit 101 was generaled by Ariel Sharon, mm-hmm. leading figure for many years. They went into a village called Kibya in the West Bank and massacred the entire population of the village. It was more than 60 people, and many of them were burned alive in the basement of their houses and shot if they tried to come out. And what was the purpose of that disproportionality in that case? It was to get Jordan to go to a fight, and then they could conquer the West Bank. In 1956, Britain, France, and Israel together conspired to launch a war against Egypt. All for their own reasons. The Nasser government in Egypt, then the leading Arab voice in the world, had nationalized the Suez Canal in the summer of 1956. Britain, France, and Israel launched this all-out war against them, and they were only stopped because the U.S. and the Soviet Union said, you know, for their own reasons, refused to accept it and stopped it. But the kind of violence that has gone on over and over again, and this disproportionality has been inflicted on Gaza, not just in the last year, but what was called Operation Cast Lead in 2008, Operation Protective Edge in 2012, where thousands of people died, thousands of people were wounded. And these were provoked where there would be something, you know, there would be something that would come from Gaza in the form of homemade rockets after some assassination Israel had carried out. And then there would be massive bombing of Gaza. And what is Gaza? Gaza is 90% of the population of Gaza are people who were evicted from their homeland in 1948, 49, or 67, or the descendants of them. One of the most densely populated areas of the entire world. So, you know, when we hear the word terrorism thrown around, what do you call a pilot who flies a plane over an apartment building filled with people and there's no air defenses at all, and then drops 2,000-pound bombs demolishing those buildings? How come that's not called terrorism? Well, of course, it's because whose side is Israel on? And it's that side is the United States. But the disproportionality, the Israelis make clear they have every intention of, this is probably the only time in my life that I've agreed with Wesley Clark.
Sadly, that history would certainly support his view, as you've just demonstrated. Well, we are just about out of time, I'm afraid, but I want you, before you go, to let our listeners know how they can find out more about your thinking, readings you think they should do, a website you think they should check in on, so that they aren't just getting CNN's version or Fox News's version of this.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I do want to say is that on October 5th, all over the world, there are going to be protests demanding an end to the war.
That's right.
In Gaza and the war in Lebanon. So here in the Bay Area, it'll actually be the next day, the 6th, and it'll be at 16th and Valencia Street. But I don't have the details in Los Angeles and elsewhere. But people should look and they'll find it and they should participate. That's the most important thing we can do. But people can go to liberationnews.org, liberationnews.org. They can go to the website of the People's Forum. Has a lot of information, the People's Forum in New York City. As you said at the beginning, you can get a copy of our book, which goes over all the history that we're talking about and more. Mm-hmm. In a way that's basic. It's got short chapters, plain language, not an academic book, but a resource for activists and people who are interested in this. And they can go to 1804books.com.
Yeah, and I've read the book, and I concur in your description of it and its usefulness. Well, Dick Becker, right, Maria, we got to move on, sadly. We thank you so much for joining us here today on the Lawyers Guild Show again.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, Dick, we'll talk soon. Bye-bye. Well, and the few minutes we have left, let's do that. And folks, if you like what you heard today, if you like what you hear on so many other stations, so many other programs here on this station, stuff that by and large you just don't hear somewhere else. Oh, you may hear hints of it if you could read between three lines or something, but you don't hear it plain spoken as Dick Becker just did. And guests that we have on week after week after week. And so we would hope that you would support our station in honor of that, that you would find, if you're listening to this station, worth listening to. We don't get government money. We don't get money from the corporations, you know, and other public radio stations and networks. They call it underwriting. Yeah, underwriting is also undermining of the freedom to say whatever the devil you want to say on a program about what that corporation and others like it may be doing to the world. You're not going to do that if you lose your corporate underwriting. But we just, we get underwritten, if you will, only by you. And that puts a real strain on us. You no doubt pay a price for your integrity, we pay a price for ours. Let's be together so that we're not washed overboard by what we're doing, and that we can keep doing it together. Giving to us is giving. It's one-stop shopping. As I say, you're contributing to the progressive movement in LA, who only has this station as its airwave voice. Am I right, Maria? Where should they call? How do they go about doing it?
You are right. Yes. Well, the easy way is kpfk.org, or you can call, do the old-fashioned way, 818-985-5735. Either way, you're good. Yeah, it looks like we have our 30-second countdown right now, Jim, but it's not too late. And you can click the little box that says Lawyers Guild, and then we get our brownie points. We love that.
Yes.
And we love and thank you all for listening.
Yes, we thank you for listening. We thank you. If you can't afford to contribute, don't worry about it. We're sorry you're in that position. Keep listening. Keep doing, I'm sure, all the other wonderful things you're doing as part of this progressive cause here in L.A. We'll be back with you again next week, same time, same place. Meanwhile, bring a smile to our face by doing what Maria said, contribute our name to kpfk.org. Till then, we thank you for listening to the Lawyers Guild Show today, of course. And until next week, on behalf of Maria Hall and myself, thanks, stay healthy, and stay active, standing up for your rights, my friends.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth.
Support comes from the Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning June 1st through October 20th with outdoor repertory theater and educational programs for all ages. The Theatricum's signature production of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream is back alongside The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, a fresh take on the J.M. Barrie classic of a boy who wouldn't grow up, Tartuffe Born Again, a new translation and adaptation of the Molière masterpiece, and the Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine Vote. The Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway in the shade of the California Live Oaks. For further information and tickets, visit www.theatricum.com or go to kpfk.org.
This is Melody King.
And this is Tom Keesh.
Hosts of the Animal Agenda, Wednesdays at 2:30 p.m.
We should tell them that KPFK is currently in fund drive mode.
And we hope you'll show your support for the important work we and the other programmers here at KPFK do by donating whatever you can to this amazing community resource. The number to call to donate is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. You can also donate securely online at kpfk.org. Thank you for supporting KPFK, and remember to tune in to the Animal Agenda Wednesdays at 2:30 p.m.
This is Sean Lee, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org.
Yes, we were born into this occupation, but we will not accept its toxic values. Instead, we can embrace the traditions modeled by the native peoples of Turtle Island for millennia. Stewardship of the land, the water, the air, respect for our plant and animal neighbors. Because this land is not our land. It belongs to the future, to the seventh generation. And the future is what we make of it. Right now, the future begins now.
Welcome to XR Now, Extinction Rebellion Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, online at kpfk.org, and your favorite podcast platforms everywhere. XR Now is your direct link to climate, ecological, and biodiversity activism, bringing you the very latest on our local movements and the intersectional fights for climate justice all over the world. We've got a great show today. We will be joined by an amazing human. We have the benefit of being joined by the senior organizer for Southern California Food and Water Watch, Andrea Vega. And Andrea has a remarkable history of getting things done. We're going to dig in with her on multiple fronts, and we'll get right to that. But first, of course, we're going to jump in with XR Now, Extinction Rebellion Radio News. Kate Swigert. Take it away, Kate.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kate Swigert. And here are this week's XR Now, Extinction Rebellion Radio, news updates. Our lead story this week is the sentencing of the pair of UK activists who threw soup on a Van Gogh painting back in 2022. Just Stop Oil's Phoebe Plummer and Anna Holland were sentenced to 2 years and 20 months in prison, respectively, by the same judge who recently handed out lengthy sentences to the Whole Truth Five. Outside the courthouse, protesting against the criminalization of nonviolent activism, 320 members of groups including Defend Our Juries, Just Stop Oil, Palestine Action, Extinction Rebellion, Animal Rising, and Greenpeace transformed the road into a photographic exhibition of political prisoners past and present. While the harsh sentences were intended to deter protesters from future acts of civil disobedience, only 2 hours after the sentencing, three Just Stop Oil members were arrested while performing a copycat protest at London's National Gallery, throwing soup on the same Van Gogh painting. And climate defiance this week disrupted a so-called climate event put on by the New York Times, which was platforming oil company executives, including Vicky Holub, the CEO of Occidental Petroleum. Holub was personally awarded more than $17 million in compensation last year while advocating fake solutions to the crisis like carbon capture. Human rights attorney Stephen Donziger called out the New York Times for greenwashing, noting on Instagram that the newspaper receives tens of millions of dollars of ad revenue each year from oil and gas companies. Of the climate defiance action, Donziger wrote, quote, "This sort of tactically intelligent disruptive activism can be highly effective. It helped push the Biden administration to pause permitting for all liquefied natural gas projects," end quote. Also this week, only days after Sunrise Movement protested in front of Vice President Kamala Harris's Los Angeles home to demand that she produce a climate plan, the Harris campaign released an economic and climate proposal that the Sunrise Movement called a significant step forward, but called for even bolder action to address the climate and ecological crises. Also in U.S. presidential campaign news, Climate Defiance released a statement from its founder, Michael Greenberg, endorsing Vice President Harris on behalf of the influential climate activism organization. The statement read in part, quote, "Our community is not monolithic on this. For many, Harris's support of fracking was a deal breaker. For many more, the Biden-Harris administration's decision to fund Israel's genocide is a bridge too far. This anger is righteous and valid. Harris is not our savior. She is not a saint. Fundamentally, she is a politician. But she is someone we can move. And move her, we will." End quote. Finally, here's Andrea Leon Grossman with this week's climate update from Sacramento.
Hi, I'm Andrea Leon Grossman from Vote Solar. Great to be back on XR Now. Governor Gavin Newsom has vetoed SB 1374, a bill designed to expand rooftop solar access for renters and schools across California. Deeply concerned advocates argue that the governor's veto blocks critical efforts to cut utility costs, address climate change, and lower emissions. The bill would have reversed a recent ruling limiting solar benefits for properties with multiple electric meters, like schools and apartment buildings. Advocates say Newsom's decision favors investor-owned utilities. All this while PG&E reports record profits and low-income communities struggle with ever-rising bills. Critics accuse the governor of stalling on climate goals and backing costly, ineffective solutions like hydrogen and carbon capture. Frankie Arona, executive director of the Society of Native Nations, even called Newsom's support for such alternatives climate arson, claiming that governor is prioritizing utilities over the well-being of Californians. Many view rooftop solar as a key tool for lowering grid costs, and giving more people access to clean energy. They see this veto as a major setback for both economic fairness and the state's climate goals. I'm Andrea Leon Grossman. We vote solar. We'll be back next week with more from Sacramento.
Andrea, before we jump back into the show, I'm just curious, what is your personal view of all of this? Let's go editorial for a moment.
I think it's cruel, and I think it's a shame that we are undermining our climate goals and we are inflicting more harm into communities that have been overburdened with dirty energy, and that we are basically ensuring that they don't get access to clean, safe energy that they deserve. And this veto is just that. It's cruel and it's, again, inflicting more harm, and it's just unfair. We need to make sure that we go 100% renewable energy, and the way to do that is by expanding access to rooftop solar. This veto is tragic in so many ways, and we need to correct it. The fact that both the Assembly and the Senate voted to approve SB 1374 and ensure that more communities have access to solar sends the message that they get it, and that we need to do right by those who don't have access to solar.
And we're back, and we are joined today, as I said at the top of the show, by Andrea Vega, the Southern California Senior Organizer for Food and Water Watch and Food and Water Action. Andrea is part of one of the, I would say, most badass climate and water and food-focused organizations on the planet. I have had the great pleasure of working with Food and Water Watch, really, I would say, now for it's about 15 years or so, maybe even a little longer than that. They are great, great humans who do very important work in a lot of places. And here today on the show, Andrea Vega, who is the senior organizer for Southern California, is going to share with us some of the fights she's in, some of the battles she's fighting, most importantly, some really interesting observations about the state of water and hydrogen and fossil fuel infrastructure here in SoCal. Welcome to XR Now, Andrea. It is great to have you on the air.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Stephen.
So, Andrea, we love to start our shows, as we always start our shows, by checking in with you and who you are, because it always makes a difference for people to understand who it is that's sharing their wisdom with us. And I am so curious about you and where you got your start and where you come from and what it was that motivated you to be in this deep work that you do every day.
Yeah. So I was raised in Southern California. I grew up in Santa Clarita. I'm an immigrant. I was born in Lima, Peru. And, at 3 years old, I ended up calling, the Los Angeles County my new home. And growing up in Santa Clarita, it is incredibly hot in the SCV. There's no doubt about it. Wildfires were pretty much the norm when you're growing up, kind of in general in California, but especially in the Santa Clarita Valley. While in other states, people have like snow days, for those growing up in Santa Clarita, we have wildfire days. Mm. Schools are closed, air quality is terrible. And growing up, I simply, unfortunately, thought like that was just the norm. When in reality, what I was seeing as a kid was some of the early stages of just a climate crisis. Mm. Back then, of course, I was, I guess, as much as like an elementary schooler can be aware that climate change is a problem. There are bad things happening. We need to save the planet. But I wasn't really, I guess, I couldn't really call myself, I wasn't really calling myself a climate person, even when I went to college. So I attended Cal State Northridge, CSUN's a fantastic institution, go Matadors. and I was a political science major, and I did my minor in women's studies. And at the time, I thought that I was going to be focusing on foreign policy. I thought that's where my career was going to go. It's kind of funny thinking back to that now, because now if you ask me, I there's no way I could ever see myself leaving the climate world. And granted, there is still a lot to do when it comes to foreign policy that's climate related, no doubt about it. But now I'm just the person that's really big on just California site fights. I finish my bachelor's at CSUN and I start, I'm like, well, I want to continue being, I want to be really politically involved. How can I make a difference? And I did one of the smartest things that I've probably ever done was getting involved in local campaigns. At the time when I finished college, my parents had actually moved from LA County to the Inland Empire. That was the first time I really became aware of the IE. And boy, is that a place to really just sink your teeth into grassroots organizing. And I started working on local campaigns, these municipal elections, these statewide propositions. And then I got my big break when I was hired for the California team for the Bernie 2020 campaign.
Okay. And that was a straight up political campaign in the Inland Empire?
So I was on the Bernie presidential campaign, but I was specifically working for their Inland Empire office.
Okay.
And this is the moment that I think back on a lot of what really pushed me into the climate world.
Had COVID hit by then, or was COVID coming, or were you already? It's interesting timing because I know the campaign was very active into the early stages of COVID.
Yes. So by COVID was pretty much coming. I started working for the Bernie 2020 campaign in late 2019, and the California primary was in March of 2020. And that's when my work on the campaign ended, since I was only on the California team. Just a lot of working on the Bernie campaign was, of course, holding these canvassing events, all these different kind of voter outreach events, phone banking. And there was one day I was knocking on doors. I remember I was in the very small community of Bloomington in San Bernardino County. I was knocking on doors, and one of the things that we would ask people is, "What's your big concern? What are you and your family worried about, and what's something that you feel that that a candidate should be focusing on?" I was expecting every single time that people would be, number one, talking about the economy. And when I was in Bloomington, for the folks who would answer the door and I would speak with them, their number one concern was not about the economy. Their number one concern was, "My kids keep getting sick and I don't know why." My kid has asthma and we have no family history of asthma. Or my family is experiencing these respiratory issues. And that totally caught me off guard. And as a, I guess, quote unquote, kind of baby organizer at the time, the only thing that I could think of saying was, "I'm so sorry that's happening to you. I'm so sorry that, you're your kid's sick, you're having respiratory issues, your loved ones are being affected by this. And there were some households that told me, I'm pretty sure that it's because of all of these warehouses. They're so close to my kid's school. They keep building them and people keep getting sick. And
just for the clarification, what was the industry that was building the warehouses?
So one of the biggest companies that's building warehouses in the Inland Empire is Amazon. Okay. Just absolutely notorious, just in general, of just terrible business practices. And I ended up, I thought about it for a very long time of like, well, this isn't quite how I was expecting these canvassing conversations to go. And I had some friends in the IE that were focusing on climate issues like the warehouses and how it relates to public health. So eventually, once my work on the Bernie campaign in California finished, I actually ended up moving back to Los Angeles County. What a time to come back, spring 2020. And I decide I want to still be an organizer. I want to still, work on making political change. And clearly what's happening with all of these various emissions, the climate crisis is a public health crisis. And I was really lucky to soon find out about Food and Water Watch. And I started working there. I remember I was at the time I was the LA organizing associate. And I've just stayed ever since. Actually, this month of September marks 3 years that I've been with the organization.
My name is Peter Kalmus. I'm an earth scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, speaking on my own behalf. I absolutely love Pacifica. I love KPFK. It's such a vital voice. I've been listening to Pacifica since 2005 when I was a graduate student in a lab at Columbia University in New York City. And I just thought it was the coolest thing, like the discussions, the sort of saltiness, trying to make a better place for all of us to live on Earth. And a lot of gratitude for that crucial voice on the left.
KPFK when you start your day or throughout the day? How about in the evenings? When you think about it, you probably spend a lot more time with KPFK than you realize. And we thank you for making us a part of your routine. It's truly a privilege to be included in your life, which is one of the main reasons why we do all this. We know that our listeners rely on KPFK programming, and we hope that we can rely on your help for this service to continue. Help KPFK to move the conversation forward. Please pledge your financial support to KPFK right now, if you can, by going to kpfk.org/donate. Or you can dial 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Easy to remember. And we thank you for being part of the family.
And And we're back with Andrea Vega, Food and Water Watch lead organizer, senior organizer in Southern California for an absolutely profound organization that's been doing great work for many, many years now. You know, Andrea, what I would ask you to do, because I don't know how much our audience knows about Food and Water Watch, but maybe you could give us a little sketch of the scope of work that Food and Water Watch is engaged in. I think that might be a useful setup for getting into the work that you're involved in now. But the organization itself has been around for a couple of decades now and has been doing, I think, extraordinary work across the country. Tell us about the scope of work.
Yeah. So for Food and Water Watch, we go even beyond just what is in our name. Of course, we work on food issues. We have folks that work specifically on big ag, on stopping factory farms, stopping mega dairies. We also have folks that work on water issues, such as how our California team, we have a campaign where we focus on protecting California's water resources by addressing the corporate entities that are abusing California's water and how that's just exacerbated the water crisis we find ourselves in. And there's also the work on stopping fossil fuels. And that's my wheelhouse. What I focus on is things like various site fights and everything that goes into stopping fossil fuel infrastructure, how big oil is a danger to our water resources, how it's a threat to public safety and public health for frontline communities, and how, of course, these fossil fuel companies do not care whatsoever about protecting ratepayers.
Mm-hmm. So before we dig into the work you're currently doing, tell our audience what a site fight is and give us an example of something recent that you've been involved in as a site fight, a sketch.
Yeah. So a site fight is when it's focused on a specific site location, fossil fuel infrastructure, in the case of what I do, and trying to get it to close down. Mm-hmm. And the what feels like never-ending struggle in the fight to phase out fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. One, the biggest and the first, actually, site fight that I started working on at Food and Water Watch was that of the notorious SoCalGas-owned Aliso Canyon gas storage facility.
Yes, yes, yes.
When I started at Food and Water Watch, this was when the California Public Utilities Commission was deciding to, in a series of many times that they would do this, expand the storage limits at Aliso Canyon. Yeah. I was a few months into the job and just... I remember still when the Aliso Canyon gas blowout happened, since I was at CSUN, and I still remember I was living at the dorms, and all of a sudden the CSUN dorms send out a notice letting students know, hey, please do not go into Porter Ranch or the surrounding areas because there is a gas leak. I was, of course, just like, oh, wow, I'm sure they'll get that dealt with soon enough. I remember one of my roommates at the time actually was supposed to be going to a study session in Porter Ranch that same day. Mm. And we were just talking about it in our room. And she was like, oh, well, I guess I probably shouldn't go to that study session. Right. And I'm like, yeah, no, this sounds kind of dangerous. You probably should just stay here. And I was so sure that it was going to be all solved and dealt with. And I didn't think about Aliso Canyon again until I started working at Food and Water Watch.
Which was a couple of years later.
A couple of years later. I was like, you know, at that point I'm learning all over again about Aliso. And I keep thinking to myself, how is it that this facility is still in operation?
And so the fact is that at that point in time, in 2020, 2019, our governor was saying to anybody who cared to listen that he was going to shut Aliso down. Mm-hmm. And he said it repeatedly. And I know he said it repeatedly because as part of Extinction Rebellion, we were very active in that moment at trying to hold the governor to